Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
So I have Carl Icahn. Does anyone know Carl Icahn? Carl is great.
Carl Icahn called me. Carl Icahn's a great guy, very successful.
You know him. Is he a racist?
I know him. I think it's ridiculous. And then you have to put people into these agencies like Scott Pruitt that's going to do the job.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about the man who ignored NASA's advice not to look into the eyes of the sun. Because, mama, that's where the fun is. Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg. So here at TrumpCast, we get caught up like everybody else in the headlines Donald Trump generates. If you listened to our show last week, we really couldn't talk about anything other than the president's apologetics for neo-Nazis, Confederate revanchists, and white supremacists. But when you get caught up in the latest outrages, you risk missing what's really happening in Donald Trump's Washington. What's happening is corruption on a scale we haven't seen in the federal government since the 1980s, and quite possibly not since the 1920s. Trump and his family are using the presidency to make money by directing customers to patronize their businesses, raising prices, and using their political power to change the rules in their favor. But you knew that already. What you might not have known is that the Trumps and Kushners are not the only people treating the White House as an unguarded piggy bank. Friends, supporters, and associates of the president are all getting in on the action. I've talked about this before on the show, but the best precedent I can come up with is Reagan's Department of Housing and Urban Development, which the senior staff essentially looted. The people running HUD in the 80s didn't think it served any real public purpose. They just saw it as a target of opportunity. And by the end of Reagan's second term, you couldn't find any programs at HUD that weren't rife with corruption. The more obscure and complicated an agency's issues are, the easier it is to swampify it. Highly technical regulatory changes that never get reviewed by Congress can be worth hundreds of millions of dollars to self-interested parties. Without ethical standards, without the enforcement of rules about disclosure and conflict of interest, it's just open season. And it's open season right now at the EPA, HHS, HUD, the FCC, Interior, Agriculture, Energy, and lots of other departments and agencies. My guest today caught one of Trump's cronies with his fingers in the till and got him fired as a special advisor to the president. I'll be back in a moment to talk about Carl Icahn with The New Yorker's Patrick Radden Keefe. But first, I want to tell you about the live show we're doing in Austin, Texas on September 23rd at the Texas Union Theater. It's part of the Texas Tribune Festival. We're going to have two special guests, Jill Abramson, the former editor of The New York Times, and Representative Joaquin Castro, who represents San Antonio, Texas as a congressman. He's one of the Castro twins. It's going to be a great show, and you can get tickets at slate.com/live. That's slate.com/live.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. My guest today is Patrick Radden Keefe. He's a staff writer in The New Yorker, and his article in the new issue is Carl Icahn's Failed Raid on Washington. Patrick, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
So this was a fantastic piece that got results. Carl Icahn has been fired, or as he says, resigned. It's really the talk of Washington. I guess I can't say the talk of the town because it's a New Yorker piece. But just for those of our listeners who may not remember the 1980s, who is Carl Icahn?
So Carl Icahn was he's a very 80s figure, right? He kind of came to prominence as one of the original corporate raiders back in the 80s, so a guy who did hostile takeovers. And he's interesting because at the time, he was this very rich guy who was said to be one of the inspirations for the Gordon Gekko character in Wall Street, but was also somewhat reviled because what he did was he came in and took over corporations, and the corporations themselves often didn't want him to. And so he was a bit of a pariah back in the 80s and even into the 90s. But these days, he is just one of the richest guys in the country. Forbes says he's worth about $17 billion, and he's kind of a fixture on CNBC. So he's kind of been embraced by Wall Street belatedly.
And he's over 80 now, but he's very, as you write, been close. Well, I don't know if you can say close, but he's had one of the people who's had a good relationship with Donald Trump for a long time. Trump likes him. He said nice things about Trump. He was a Wall Street person who supported Trump from early on, right?
Yeah, well, Trump, I mean, it's interesting because he was one of the few Wall Street people who came out early on and really bet on Trump. And at a time when Goldman Sachs folks were saying nasty things about Trump, and Trump was saying nasty things about Goldman Sachs, and he had a really a slightly tense relationship with the more traditional financier crowd in New York, Icahn kind of embraced Trump and said, look, I'm gonna stand by this guy. I've known him for decades. And the big issue for Icahn was deregulation. He said, I think Trump's going to go in there and cut regulations back. And on that basis, he threw his weight behind Trump.
So let's get to the grotesque corruption, or I guess maybe aborted corruption, at the heart of this story, which has to do with an effort at deregulation, or I don't even know if you call it deregulation, but changes in regulation that would benefit Icahn personally and materially. What did he try to do?
So it gets pretty complicated, but in essence, Icahn is the major stockholder in a refiner, a Texas-based oil refiner called CVR. And under the Renewable Fuel Standard, which is a law passed under George W. Bush that tries to incentivize the blending of ethanol and other biofuels into gasoline, the refiner that Icahn owns was obliged to buy these credits, these renewable fuel credits. They either had to blend the ethanol, or if they didn't do that, they had to buy these credits. And at the time when he purchased his stake in 2012 in the refiner, those credits cost very little. They cost about a nickel each. But the price had gone up and up and up for the credits. And so by last summer, by the summer of 2016, this refiner, CVR, was paying about $200 million a year to purchase these credits. And this drove Icahn berserk. And actually, long before Trump seemed like the presumptive nominee or a really legitimate candidate for the White House, Icahn was out in a very public way saying the EPA, which regulates this system with the credits, needs to change what they call the point of obligation. So basically, refiners like mine, merchant refineries like this, should not be the ones who have to purchase these credits or blend the ethanol. You need to shift that point of obligation basically closer to the gas pump. So it was this pretty obscure rule that he became totally obsessed with. And talking to people who know him, this is kind of typical of Icahn. He's hugely wealthy. He has interests all over the place. But if there's one small thing that begins to drive him crazy, he'll just obsess over it. And he became obsessed over this particular rule.
And to be clear, there's no kind of intrinsic right or wrong here. I mean, because Iowa has outsized political power, we have corn-based ethanol in our gasoline. And some people argue that it's been environmentally beneficial, and some people argue that it's been a massive boondoggle. I'm a little bit on the massive boondoggle side. But this isn't like pro-environment versus anti-environment. This is the interests of certain refiners versus the oil companies, or certain refiners versus other refiners, right?
Yeah, I mean, the current arrangement under the renewable fuel standard, you would be hard pressed to find someone who would tell you it's working really well. There are all kinds of critics who have, I think, legitimate bases for criticizing the way in which the standard operates today, and various people who have disagreements about how you would fix it. You know, whether you would make fixes to the current arrangement, whether you would draw up whole new legislation. It was important for me in writing this article to be somewhat agnostic on the merits of the actual argument that ICOM was making, because to me, the argument is not the point. It's actually a story about government process.
And I think that's exactly right. I'm not sure there are any merits, but what ICOM did is just so clearly corrupt. I mean, he essentially, and I'm going to kind of characterize your story maybe a little more casually than you carefully document what happened here, but he essentially started saying to people, look, Trump's going to sign an executive order changing this regulation so that it's no longer the responsibility of these oil refiners to get these credits. And then it sounds like he sent Trump an executive order, which he wrote in a half-assed, not knowing how to write an executive order way, for Trump to sign. And the price of these credits, which trades very non-transparently, shot down because he created the impression that Trump was about to do this, and he was then able to buy the credits he needed on the cheap.
Yeah, I mean, that's more or less tracks with what I was able to document. There was a period of time in February. I mean, part of what's fascinating about this story is it's weeks into the new administration. You know, you're not even talking about the first 100 days here. And you have this really obscure EPA rule that nobody's ever heard of. But it's a major issue for this one guy, Carl Icahn, who Trump had appointed to this sort of novel position. His title was special advisor to the president for, I think, regulatory affairs or something to that effect. But it was unusual, as these appointments go, because he didn't need to disclose anything. He didn't need to give up any of his assets. And he comes in, and pretty much the first thing he does in that capacity is to urge Trump to make this change that will directly benefit him. And we know this in part because he'd been really aggressively kind of publicly lobbying for this change in the months leading up to the election. And as he's doing this, yeah, he's also meeting with folks in industry and essentially, you know, not saying necessarily and explicitly I'm speaking for the president, but saying I've talked to the president. It looks like he's going to make this change.
I'm the special advisor to the president on this stuff. I mean, he clearly has the title that allows him to imply he's speaking for the president.
Well, so I interviewed this guy, Bob Dineen, who runs one of the leading trade groups for ethanol, who ends up negotiating with ICOM, and basically, initially what happened is he completely changed the stance of his organization. They had always opposed the idea that you would shift the point of obligation, and he goes into these meetings with ICOM, and he comes out and he says, we've done an about-face, we're going to make this change. And initially, when he was asked about this by the press, he said, oh, you know, a Trump administration official told me this change was coming. And then, certainly with me, he said, look, the only Trump administration official I ever talked to was Carl Icahn.
So it's a conflict of interest. It looks like insider trading. Why isn't Carl Icahn being indicted and prosecuted right now?
I think there are a bunch of answers to that. I mean, in talking with Icahn and in talking with his lawyer, they make a bunch of different arguments. I mean, they claim that he never had an official role, which I think is kind of nonsense. I mean, there was a press release put out by the transition with quotes from Trump saying he's going to come in, he's going to have this title. There are questions in terms of whether it would be an insider trading case, that, you know, the fact that he was making, he was essentially shorting the value of these credits. The credits are a commodity, so it wouldn't be a securities case. But there could still certainly be a fraud case there. I talked to lawyers who thought that there would be. But the other thing is, look, there's a federal statute that says that if you are an executive branch employee other than the president and the vice president, you cannot give advice on a matter in which you have a personal financial interest.
You also can't manipulate the markets, right? I mean, short of insider trading, it was illegal to manipulate commodities markets before anybody was being prosecuted for insider trading in the stock market.
Exactly. Well, and in fact, there are broad kind of fraud statutes in which, in theory, yeah, you could say, look, if you're in a situation in which you're out there, whether it's that you know secret information that other people don't, or in some ways almost worse, right, you're trying to kind of convey an impression in the market that something's going to happen that maybe isn't going to happen. Certainly, you can look at the value of these credits, and there's just, when you look at when exactly the value dropped, and you map that with the news of these conversations that Icahn was having, it's just, there's no way not to conclude that he was driving the price down.
Patrick, I'm more outraged than you are about this. I mean, this guy, I mean, he deserves a fair trial like everybody, but he should be in jail. I mean, what he did, he should be in jail.
Yeah, I think the crazy thing is that and this was a frustration for me as a reporter, right? I don't have subpoena power. So in terms of the trades, it would be really interesting to find out when and how those were authorized and how, again, that maps on to the timeline of the conversations he was having with folks in the administration. But you get to this kind of crazy situation where is the Trump Justice Department going to investigate? I don't think so. You had a whole bunch of Democratic senators who've written a whole string of outraged letters about Icahn to anyone who they can think of, and they're not really getting responses. They're not really getting any traction. So you did have this kind of interesting situation, which was within, a week before my piece came out, the White House told me, hey, you know what, Icahn's no longer working for us in any capacity. And then hours before my piece posted, Icahn announced himself that he was stepping down, which I think seems to indicate that they're aware that there's real impropriety.
Well, in this case, they succeeded in firing him before he quit.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And I can document that. Though it says actually a lot, I think, about the psychology. It's interesting because Icahn and Trump share a certain kind of, I thought of it as like this kind of simian dominance code, right, where there's only ever an alpha and a beta in any interaction. And so I did think it was interesting that the White House kind of broke up with him before he could break up with them. And then in his press release announcing he's stepping down, he says, this was my decision. You know, I did this. It's not that they let me go.
And it was the week of Charlottesville, but he didn't say it anything. I mean, this was the week that all his other business advisors were resigning from their commissions and appointments and the councils. But his didn't have anything to do with that. It was because of your story.
Exactly. And I have to say, I mean, I think on some level, part of what's interesting to me about the Icahn story is it's primarily the financial press that covers this guy. And it is amazing to me the degree to which they will stenographically take down whatever he says in terms of him explaining. And so there was, in fact, after he resigned, there was this whole kind of round of stories in which if you just read the headline of the story, you would think, here's another guy who's been kind of pushed to a crisis of conscience by the awful events in Charlottesville. And in fact, if you read Icahn's statement, there's none of that at all. It had nothing to do with it didn't in any way, I don't think, inform his motivation.
It was sort of convenient timing for him. But back to this question of prosecution. So as you say, we can't exactly look to the Trump Justice Department to thoroughly investigate this. I hate to say it, we need another special prosecutor for this case, right? I mean, it's clearly federal. I mean, you might have a New York prosecutor who would take it on if because of the abdication of the Justice Department, but there should be a federal investigation, and you need an independent prosecutor to do it.
I think that's probably right. I will say, as I was working on the piece, I heard a number of rumors from different people suggesting that that Schneiderman, the Attorney General in New York, might be looking into this. I couldn't get any confirmation of that, but I did talk to Elliot Spitzer, who had held that job in the past, and he said, "Oh yeah, if this came across my desk, and I was sitting, in my old office, we would absolutely take a hard look at this." But yeah, I mean, I could look. I think there is a broader context of conflicts of interest here, and this is one case. It strikes me as an especially egregious one, but I think that there are a bunch of different areas that you could have somebody looking into, and probably in a fairly fruitful way. I think it tells you a lot that Walter Schaub, who, when he was inside the government, was making noise about these ethics issues, ends up basically being forced to resign and now speak about it from the outside.
Well, the idea of any kind of ethics advisor or inside the White House is obviously a joke. I guess the question is more about, how you remedy it in the absence of that. But, you know, what's interesting, as you say here, is this sort of, this isn't just an instance, it's a parable of a lot of instances, maybe a particularly egregious one. But I think we have tended to concentrate in the Trump-watching community on the ways in which the president is enriching himself and his family by using the White House and the presidency. Obviously outrageous, but what tends to get overlooked is that there are a lot of other people doing it too, and that he's letting this happen, encouraging it, abetting it. And Carl Icahn presumably is not the only crony of Trump's who thinks he might be able to pocket a few $100 million by basically corrupting the regulatory or deregulatory process.
Not at all. And it's amazing. I mean, both in his conversation with me and in his resignation letter, the craziest thing is Icahn admits, and I think he thinks this is exculpatory, he says, the only issue I ever advised on, the only issue I ever told Trump what to do about was this one where I had some skin in the game. So he comes out and essentially says, outside the four corners of my own self-interest, I didn't have any regulatory ideas that I was bringing to the president. I mean, the way this whole piece got started for me was I had a conversation in February with someone. I was meeting with a source, a financier, actually about a different story, and he mentioned Icahn, who he knew. And what he said to me at the time was, there's this whole circle of people around Trump who essentially are regarding this presidency as it's like a corporate raid on Washington. They're going to go in and get what they can get. And that was the theme that came up again and again, talking both to finance folks who know these people in New York, but also to government folks in Washington who I think feel a little bit blindsided by this mentality. Even people in the Trump administration, there's a guy who works for Gary Cohen, a guy named Mike Catanzaro, who works on the National Economic Council, who ended up kind of putting the brakes on this Icahn executive order. And I talked to a couple of people who Catanzaro has spoken to, so they were characterizing for me conversations with him. But one of them said, you know, Mike essentially was forced to say, hey, look, the government is not a vending machine for the president's friends. And this guy said, you know, unfortunately, not everybody in this administration takes that view. I mean, some people really do seem to think that it is there to be pillaged.
So I guess just a last question about Icahn himself. I mean, this guy, as you say, is worth $17 billion. He is over 80 years old. Why does he want to risk going to jail to make a few hundred more million dollars?
I don't know that he fully appreciated the risks going in. And I think that, strangely, for a guy who's so sophisticated, he was actually a little bit naive about how easy or hard it would be to engineer this kind of thing in Washington, to change a regulation. But look, I think there's something compulsive about Icahn, and some of it, he has a really interesting backstory, and I think issues from his own childhood that I'm not playing armchair psychologist here, because he talks about them relentlessly, where there's clearly some hole that this guy is trying to fill. He said himself, I mean, there's an amazing line, years and years ago, when he was less than 81, someone asked him, hey, you know, you're never going to be able to spend all the money you've got. Why keep making it? And what he said was, it's a way of keeping score. And I wonder if, you know, if that's your mindset, I wonder if it's possible to stop.
Every line in the movie Wall Street is like something Carl Icahn actually said.
Well, and in fact, the line, if you want a friend, get a dog, came after Oliver Stone, while researching the film, went and met with Carl Icahn.
But he didn't say lunch is for wimps. Wasn't that from Wall Street too?
Yeah, exactly. That may have been someone else.
I've been speaking to Patrick Radden Keefe of The New Yorker. His story in the new issue, which you must read, is about Carl Icahn's failed raid on Washington. Patrick, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
I've been in this business since 69. Most of these Harvard MBA types, they don't add up to dog shit. Give me guys that are poor, smart, and hungry, and no feelings. You win a few, you lose a few, but you keep on fighting. And if you need a friend, get a dog.
That's it for today's show. But I have one request. Would you give us a rating and review on iTunes? The rating might be, for example, 5 stars. And in the review, you might say, for example, why you like it. But you don't have to do it. Just go to Apple Podcasts and give us a rating. Also, are you listening to Slate's Hang Up and Listen? It's one of the best sports shows out there. I listen to it, even though I'm not that into sports, because it's such a good and interesting show. Every Monday, Josh Levine and company break down the latest storylines in sports. You can hear them discuss football in the wake of Charlottesville with a former NFL player. Check that out by going to slate.com/hangup. That's slate.com/hangup. Today's show was produced by Jason DeLeon. Thank you, Jason. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.